The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
New 7-week series is hitting the box with Rory O'Connell exploring the cultural sights and sounds of Morocco. And of course, given the nature of the man, the food of Morocco. It's called How to Cook Well in Morocco. It's going to be on the telly next Wednesday, April 16th on RTE1 at 8:30. Rory, of course, chef, teacher, co-founder of Ballymaloe Cookery School. Rory, Morocco, as far as I am clear in my own head, which means not very, is basically tagines and raisins. That's my sum total knowledge. What am I missing?
Well, you're missing a lot more. I mean, tagine is, of course, very important. And we can talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But if we think of the sort of geography of the country, you know, starting in Tangier, which is just basically south of Europe, all the way down as far as the desert, they've got an incredible agricultural possibility, which they absolutely use. So, you know, from dates, oranges, all manner of vegetable that we'd be used to seeing, and some that we wouldn't. Incredible fish, because they're on the Mediterranean, they're in the top of Tangier, and also the Atlantic all the way down the side. Incredible olives, wheat, grain. It's a huge shopping basket or ingredient basket for the cook. So, I mean, amazing things to be found. Not to mention the spices and all sorts of things like that.
Also, as I understand it, something of a melting pot, because it having been invaded by a multitude of different cultures over the years creates an interesting mix of cuisine.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly in Tangier, for example, because you can imagine Tangier right there at the top of North Africa, just south of Europe. I mean, you can see it from Spain. And it was incredibly important strategically. So the Portuguese, the French, the British, way back the Phoenicians, the Greeks were even there. So they will all have left something behind, you know, in terms of the mixture of food that's there. And the other thing that's very important to remember about Moroccan food and Moroccan cuisine is that it's what's known as a royal cuisine. So that refers to the cooking in countries that where the highest possibility of that cooking was developed in the royal palaces. And they were all trying to outdo each other in all the different palaces. So that brought a level of sophistication, I suppose, a level of experimentation to the cooking that was going on. So, that definitely affected everything.
Give us a sense of the kind of dishes that it produced. Give us an example of what fits in that royal cuisine category.
Well, you know, the tagines you talk about, it can range from a very simple kind of classic tagine with lemons and olives, and then great big tagines with plums and dates and raisins and saffron and rose water served with couscous, which might have had baby goat in it, for example. And then lots and lots of fresh herbs. It's amazing when you travel around the country. There are wonderful food markets everywhere. And the people are shopping in a very unconspicuous, very uncontrived way in those markets. So clearly, the food is being produced. They're buying the food, they're taking it home, and they're cooking at home. A lot of cooking goes on in the homes in Morocco still.
Now, give us some technique advice on this, Roy, because you mentioned couscous, and couscous is one of those things that sounds wonderful in notion, but often when you cook it, it comes right out as a solid lump that you could use as a foundation stone of a small building.
Yeah, well, I would say, Anton, have a recipe to hand and measure your ingredients. So the couscous that we use in this part of the world is pre-cooked. So really all you have to do is, you know, put it into a bowl. You might put a little bit of olive oil in. You might put raisins or sultanas or dates or nothing at all in. And then what's key is the correct quantity of liquid that you add to it, whether that's a chicken stock or a vegetable stock or even water. And honestly, Anton, it's as simple as that. And then not to play with it too much, really. Just pour over the liquid. Leave it sit for half an hour to sort of, you know, to rehydrate and for the couscous to absorb the moisture. And then you have a blank canvas to which you can add your herbs, your fruit, your vegetables and so on. It's an amazing food, really.
And it's essentially pasta, isn't it? Isn't that the core ingredient of couscous? That's basically what it is.
You could describe it as being a tiny little pasta. It's basically a little nib of flour, if you like. But as I said, the couscous we get in this part of the world is pre-cooked. Now, I had, on one of the programs when I was in just the foothills of the Atlas Mountains, we cooked couscous from scratch. That's the raw couscous. And that takes about 2 hours. It's cooked over a steamer. There's broth underneath the steamer. Then there's lots of vegetables added at various different stages. And that's a whole thing. And it was wonderful. And because we cooked that particular couscous over fire, there was a slight sort of smoked flavor to it, which was really wonderful.
Oh, it's almost like a paella by sand then.
Well-ish, no. Sorry to be so blunt there, but there you go.
Well, I would have thought if you're cooking outside over a fire over an extended period of time, gradually adding things to a starch. Are we not in the ballpark?
Also in the sunshine, mind you. Yeah. You could definitely think about that sort of thing, yeah. But it's sort of a deeper pot, and it's a slower sort of cooking process. It takes about 2 hours. I mean, I think if you cooked your paella for 2 hours, you might be able to serve it in slices.
What then about rose water? Because my only knowledge of rose water, you mentioned it as one of the other ingredients in some of the royal tagines. My only knowledge of that is in Turkish Delight, and it's questionable even there. Does it serve a useful purpose?
Fair enough. Well, what I would say about rose water is there's an optimum amount. And if you use too much, it's like you've gone head first down into a bubble bath or something like that. It can have that sort of thing. But rose water and orange blossom water, so they should just bring a very delicate, scented sort of flavor to the dishes. So you shouldn't taste something and go, rose water. You should be tasting something and then after a while you go, oh, there's rose water in here. And then it's sort of floral and delicious. And then, because this is really important, Anton, about Moroccan cuisine, it's about a balance of lots of different flavors. One of the really important ingredients in Moroccan cuisine is what's called a preserved lemon. And that's basically a lemon that's been sort of slit open slightly and buried in salt for at least a month. So it's really sour and really salty. And then when you put that with the other ingredients in Moroccan cooking, many of which are sweet, you know, like raisins and dates and sultanas and apricots, yeah, then the sweet, the sour and the saltiness of the preserved lemon balances with the sweet ingredients, balances with the rose water and so on.
And that's, can really you get important. All of this stuff in Ireland now?
Oh, you can. All of the supermarkets, everywhere's got couscous. Most places, if you can't get your rose water, your orange blossom water in the supermarket, you get it in good food shops, or even the chemist back in the day used to be the source for the rose water and those sort of scented waters. Yeah, you know, and all of the, yes, it's very easy to get the ingredients.
That must be some shift for you, because I imagine that when you started out cooking, the availability of those kind of ingredients in Ireland, you'd be travelling if you were lucky enough to find anywhere that sold that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you would. It was much more niche, no doubt about it, back in the day. So the basket of ingredients that we have available to us in Ireland now would have been unimaginable 30 or 40 years ago. No doubt about it. You're absolutely right about that. And so that has opened up all sorts of possibilities. And one of the possibilities is Moroccan cooking. I mean, what's not often thought about Moroccan cooking, because the range of ingredients they use is so wide, it's really potentially an extremely healthy type of diet. There are lots of vegetables, lots of fruit, meat and fish, not a lot of meat, but carefully chosen. And then it'll be surrounded by, you know, the fruit, the vegetables, the spices, the scented waters, the sour and salty lemon, all of those things. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of magical, really.
On the topic of the spices, you mentioned saffron, which I think is top three most expensive, not just ingredients, but things by weight on the planet. How much of it do you have to use? Because saffron gets pricey in ingredients.
It's the most expensive spice of all, and often just a pinch, really. And one of the really interesting things I discovered was how to tell the difference between real saffron, which is a tiny little astigma from a crocus, and they are grown by hand, harvested by hand, and those tiny little stigmas, which are like threads, are picked out by hand. And that's really the reason why the spice is so expensive. It can't be done mechanically. But what you want to make sure that when you're paying your king's ransom for your saffron, that you're getting the real thing. So I discovered how to tell the difference between real and fake. and simply done, you sprinkle a little bit of the so-called saffron on water, and if it floats, it's real, and if it sinks straight away to the bottom of the water, it's fake. So that was a good discovery.
Oh, I'm going to go home and raid the press this evening and start floating my saffron to see what I've got.
Yeah, yeah.
It's because one of those dishes where you have to think, who was the first man to decide that or woman to decide that? Who looked at a crocus and thought, you know what I could do? I could pluck out its sex organs and lash them in dinner and see what
I
it's know. Like.
It's gas, really. I think about that about so many ingredients, you know. Who was the brave or the really hungry or the foolhardy person who decided that, you know, that a tomato wasn't going to kill you stone dead, you know?
Or mushrooms. How many? What was the process of elimination and how many died working out which are the ones that we can eat and which are the ones that we can't?
Exactly, exactly. Unfortunately, those people have disappeared into the mists of time. It's the people who discover the good things to eat are celebrated.
Well, on the topic of mushrooms and fungi generally, can I ask you a question about trends in food and what irks you? Because I've noticed that for some reason, truffle is now getting deployed in everything. And truffle, while it may be wonderful in certain settings, it has limited broader appeal in my humble view. What are the things in cooking now that irk you because they are being used either wrongly or too much?
Well, food and fashion has always been a thing, and we always keep an eye on that, obviously, because it's always nice to know what's going on. But you know yourself, I mean, something can become an internet sensation now within the click of a switch or the click of a mouse or whatever, and people go crazy for it. I mean, you know, from my point of view as a cook, something's got to taste delicious, and it's got to be as much as possible or wherever possible ethically produced. And in terms of truffle, as you mentioned, there's a product which I'm sure you know well called truffle oil. Now, that's not the oil of a truffle. It's little shavings of truffle that are put into the oil to flavor the oil. And honest to God, Anton, a lot of that is rough enough, you know, really, because as you say, a great truffle is a absolute gift, but too much truffle is just quite simply too much truffle. But so we are you know, really focused on good quality produce, as much Irish produce as we can. But I can't get my raisins from Ireland or my dates, so I'm very happy to buy those from Morocco or wherever. But not, you know, not getting too sort of carried away by something that by the new kid on the block, but looking at it and seeing if it's legitimate and if it's delicious.
The other thing, you mentioned the internet and the effect that it has. The other thing that I suspect the internet has created is a weird kind of food fascism where dishes now have to conform to an absolute perfect standard. So the sort of the carbonara where you used to get away with lashing a bit of cream into it because, you know, it was easier than doing it the proper way, it's now almost up there with a war crime. You have to follow exact original recipes or...
Oh my God, you'd get ferocious abuse altogether if somebody heard you were putting the wrong thing into a carbonara. I quite agree with you. I mean, it's ludicrous, honestly. On the other hand, it has to be said that, and carbonara is a very good example, that when it's made in the correct way, without the cream, but with just the eggs and the pasta cooking water, it's one of the triumphs of the kitchen. And we'll give it to the Italian kitchen, I suppose. But yeah, you could get terrible abuse if you were if you put your own twist on something. I mean, it's nonsense, really. You know, so many of us, Anton, are so well fed and so spoiled in many ways. And then, on the other hand, in parts of the world, as we know only too well, people are not spoiled and they're hungry. So, you know, I think we need to keep a bit of perspective on this and just be glad of what we have.
Although I get that sense that despite that, Rory, you're still not letting me under the wire with my 2-hour paella, no?
No, sorry, I'm not letting you off of that. That's just, it's never meant to be served in slices.
Rory O'Connell, thank you very much. And you can see Rory on How to Cook Well in Morocco. It is airing next Wednesday, April 16th on RT1 at 8:30.
Thank you, Anton. A great pleasure.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.